Job, actually, we stopped in the middle of his last response to Zophar and actually Eliphaz. And he's responding now with, some complaint, some frustration with things that are going on, but not so much of a complaint as an answer to Eliphaz's statement that, you know, the wicked are punished. Job is actually expressing a dilemma. He's wondering, why are the wicked not punished? Or why aren't they punished enough? And so he begins in chapter 24, though. Again, when you're reading the book of Job, understand that this would have never been divided in chapters and verses when it was written. So this would have been just all one message, one speech of response of Job to Eliphaz. He says, since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know Him see not His days? And what he's intimating there is, since God sees all things, why is it that there are those who don't know Him, but yet they don't see days of punishment? They don't see recompense. They don't see God working in a way that would hold them accountable. And then he goes on to describe what they do. He says, some remove landmarks, and they seize flocks violently and feed on them. Now, the removal of landmarks was mentioned as something the Lord definitely hated. It was one of those things that was despicable, because what you do by removing someone's landmark is you expand your borders a little bit illegally, and if he was a poor neighbor, he'd have no recourse against you. He'd be stuck. There's nothing he could, do to take you to issue for that. And it was kind of a cheap way of expanding your territory. Just taking advantage of the weak, seizing flocks violently and then feeding on them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless and take the widow's ox as a pledge. They abuse those who can't fight back, taking their assets, using force. The poor are forced often into difficult circumstances. They push the needy off the road, and the poor of the land are forced to hide. Indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to work, searching for food. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. They gather their fodder in the field and glean in the vineyard of the wicked, and they spend the night naked without clothing and have no covering in the cold. So Job is expressing the poor and their circumstance. And again, why are these, since God knows all these things, the days are not hidden, times are not hidden, why are the wicked not seeing his response? According to Zophar, Eliphaz, Bildad, they all are saying the wicked are punished. So Job is bringing up in his argument, his defense, no, there are many times that is simply not the case. And he's just recounting things that they would have been very familiar with. So their arguments toward Job really are weak. It seems it's easy to point the finger at someone who is suffering or sick and, ascribe blame to them as a result of that, but they don't logically then think through the other side. Well, wait a second. If this person who is sick and suffering is suffering as a result of sinning against God and doing something wrong, then why are there so many that are wicked and getting away with murder? Which is basically Job's comment. He says, he goes on about these poor, they're wet with the showers of the mountains and huddle around the rock for want of shelter. So they're in deplorable conditions, yet they've done nothing other than just being oppressed by the rich. Some snatch the fatherless from their breast and take a pledge from the poor. In other words, if someone would owe someone, had nothing to pay, they would actually take their children and raise them up as their own children or raise them up as slaves. They cause the poor to go naked without clothing. They take away the sheaves from the hungry. They press out oil within their walls and tread wine presses, yet suffer thirst. The dying groan in the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong. Not the poor, but the rich who are oppressing the poor. Now, God does not charge them with wrong. Job has already expressed before that he sees ultimately judgment will come, and he rests his confidence in that. But you cannot judge before the time. But why aren't these judged? His argument is to Eliphaz. Okay, why does God not charge these with wrong? Why are they getting away with it? There are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its ways, nor abide in its paths. The murderer rises with the light. He kills the poor and the needy. And in the night he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer waits for twilight, saying, "No one will see me," and he disguises his face. Literally, he puts on woman's clothing in that culture in order to be seen among the women's tents. The best disguise you do is put on woman's clothing, sneak in, sneak out. And that's what Job is saying they did. In the dark, they break into houses, which they marked for themselves in the daytime. They do not know the light, for the morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. If someone recognizes them, they're in the terrors of the shadow of death. So they hide from the light. People that hate the light, they do their deeds in darkness, in the shadows, so that no one can see them and recognize them. It's true for just about any sin. There's generally shame attached to that. And so generally people will sin in secret. They're not going to openly steal something and advertise, "Look, I'm a thief. I don't mind. It's kind of cool. It's a great occupation." You're never going to have someone own up to that. Or an adulterer will relabel it. You know, "Well, we're just swinging, you know, couples. You know, we're into the free thing. You know, that's everything's cool." And everyone has a different name for sin because they don't want to own up to it. A drunkard will be just a social drinker. He's, you know, a partier. We don't want to own up to the actual sin of it. So this is what Job is expressing in just the way that they do things in the dark so not to be recognized. He said, "They should be swift on the face of the waters. Their portion should be cursed in the earth." He's now really picturing the opinions of his counselors. If their view was correct, all the wicked should be experiencing punishment. In other words, they should be suffering the consequences of what they're doing if these friends of Job were right. "See that no one would turn into the way, so that no one would turn into the way of their vineyards." So in other words, they would be suffering, they would be in difficult circumstances. "As drought and heat consume the snow water, so the grave consumes those who have sinned. The womb should forget him, and the worm should feed sweetly on him. He should be remembered no more, and wickedness should be broken like a tree. For he preys on the barren who do not bear, but does no good for the and does no good for the widow." So, if this was the case, if God punished the wicked, then these guys should have these things happen to them. You know, this pick strong language here. The worm feeding sweetly on him. It gives you kind of a mental picture of that. And the idea of judgment and accountability for their sin. But that is not the case. "But God draws the mighty away with his power. He rises up, but no man is sure of life. He gives them security, and they rely on it. Yet his eyes are on their ways. They are exalted for a little while, and then they're gone. They are brought low, then they're taken out of the way. Like all others, they dry out like the heads of grain. If it is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing?" In other words, if this is not the case, then just show me. Now, most of the time when Job had solid arguments, Bildad or Zophar, Eliphaz, they never really responded to his answers. They just went into some other, you know, soliloquy as they were talking to themselves, basically, not really responding to his answers. And they really don't have an answer for this. They don't respond to this. In fact, Chapter 25 gives us the very short response of Bildad, which is no response. He's actually repeating something that Eliphaz said before. And there's really, Job basically continues on speaking with no rebuttal. There is no answer to his arguments in this respect. So Bildad, the Shuhite, answered and said, "Dominion and fear belong to him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light rise? How then can man be righteous before God? How can he be pure who is born of a woman? If even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm?" So Bildad was the traditionalist. You know, he did not hear his argument. He had his mind set. He's got his traditions. God has worked the same way for thousands of years in his mind. This is how it's worked. This is what my fathers have taught me. And so therefore, there can be no other answer to this. I like someone who can really think on their feet. I like someone who doesn't just give pat answers to things. And really can think into a situation, see both sides of it, and wisely choose with the help of the Lord. But Bildad is just, you know, he's kind of like one of these old traditionalists. You know, he can't see the obvious. He can't even see the very thing in front of him. He has no answer for Job. Certainly, he has no comfort for Job, which he should have been doing considering Job's condition. Well, Job answered and said, "How have you helped him who is without power?" In other words, now he's putting him to the task. What did that say? I mean, he recognizes, he just repeats what Eliphaz said. What are you doing to help me? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? How have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from you? The dead tremble, and those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering. So now he goes on, he leaves off really describing these guys and almost as answering a charge that they had made against Job before. They were very much attacking Job because they felt that Job was taking away God's sovereignty. That in their opinion, Job, by saying he had done nothing to deserve punishment, that God was unjust, that God has made a mistake, that God was in error. And so they went on about these long diatribes about how God is great and God can do this and he's that, he's powerful. So Job wants them to know he understands that about God. He knows God is awesome. He knows God is power. And he demonstrates this in chapter 26, Job's longest speech, where actually the he goes all the way on through chapter 31. But he goes all the way here from chapters 26 through 31 to describe the greatness of God, the power of God, the majesty of God in the wonders of creation. This is where, from these passages, we get many marvelous insights into the world around us that are especially amazing because some of these things that Job expressed were not very widespread knowledge in the days, even just, you know, 1,000 years ago. Some of the things he expresses are very scientifically accurate. Now, that may not mean a whole lot to you, but if you frequent a lot in writings, ancient writings, especially writings of various religions and cults and viewpoints that are quite of antiquity, you will find that there are many spurious ideas of science that people have put forth in ancient writings. Certain things that were common knowledge. In fact, the amazing thing is that common knowledge in Job's day would have been quite different from what Job is expressing. He's going way out as one who is saying things that were not fitting into the popular theories. Many of the nations of the peoples from the various continents and nations had certain gods that they served, certain viewpoints about nature, about the world, about the heavens. And they're all kind of strange, depending upon, you know, the powers of the unseen forces they couldn't understand or describe. They would ascribe to some god, and Job describes that the one and true living God has created these things. So he begins in verse 7 by stretching us out with some things that I think are quite fascinating. He says he stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. So describing these mysteries, he's emphasizing the greatness of God. But what is he ascribing here that is so fascinating? Well, the very fact that he would say he stretches out the north over empty space. There is, at least to the naked eye, kind of a void of stars over the north. Whether that is what Job is referring to, or he's referring to just fitting this with the next phrase, which Hebrew poetry that would fit, that there's nothing over the north that's holding this earth up. And notice he says he hangs the earth on nothing. Now we know that. We know the earth is not hung up on anything. It's not sitting on anything. It's not sitting on the arms of Atlas. Atlas is not holding up the earth. It's not on top of, you know, a turtle. atop four elephants. It's not, you know, I mean, some weird science that people had in their ideas in the past. Job, the oldest book in the Bible, which goes back into the time of Abraham. You're talking over 4,000 years old. 4,000 years ago, this was written, and this guy tells us a modern account of cosmology. I mean, this is very accurate. This is the fascinating thing. You understand that what he's saying here is that the fact the earth was on nothing, they didn't know that. There was no way they could determine that. This was not common knowledge, yet Job seems to know it. Notice also, he binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken. Now, fascinatingly enough about this, in this particular aspect of thinking of the clouds, this whole idea of hydrology is quite interesting. How is it that water could even go up into the sky to begin with? Again, this was a great mystery. Water was heavier than air. They knew that. You pour out water on the ground, it falls to the ground. Rain comes to the ground. But how does all that moisture get up in the clouds to begin with if water is heavier than air? It doesn't make sense. How does it happen? Well, it just so happens that water vapor, water in the gaseous state, is lighter than air. And it goes up because it's lighter than air. It evaporates, the water vapor goes up, but then what happens is it condenses to form the clouds over dust particles. Now you've got another dilemma. If the clouds then have the actual particles of water in them, because water vapor is invisible. You cannot see water vapor. There's water vapor all around us. But the clouds are visible. The water's starting to condense. Well, now that's heavier than air. Why isn't it falling right away? Why would clouds even build up to a certain point? Well, it's colder up there. It's warmer down here. The wind currents are constantly going up, so they keep aloft these heavier-than-air clouds until a point where the saturation reaches a point where it now comes to the ground. The idea here is it's incredibly balanced. It's an incredible system. This idea of the evaporation, if the earth did not have, or be, if it was not covered by three-quarters water, three-quarters of the surface of the earth is water through the oceans, there would be no way that enough water could evaporate to sustain life as we know it today. If it was half land and half ocean, most of the world would be a barren desert. There would not be enough water to sustain life. But with the three-quarters of this world being water, enough evaporation takes place to create the condensation to give life. So it is an incredible balance that God has made, and Job brings this out. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. How does he do this? It's a mystery. Well, he recognizes this. He covers the face of his throne and spreads his cloud over it. In other words, God's presence is invisible. There's no one that can look into the heavens and say, okay, this is what God is like. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. Now, some would argue Job is just describing what he sees, but the idea of circular, there's a little more insight here than normal. He's describing the earth as a circular globe, very scientifically accurate. In Isaiah, the prophet describes the earth as a sphere. And then in another place in Job, he describes the earth turning like a pot on a wheel. Now, that to me, if you really think about it, written 4,000 years ago, is quite accurate. When it was not long ago where people thought that the sun actually rose and then set, that the sun was going around the earth. Galileo was the one that challenged that cosmology. And he expressed the way the solar system, at least a better accurate view of the solar system, and he took a lot of flack for his views because it went against modern science. And yet had people read their Bibles and seen this here, they would have known that the earth was a sphere, that it rotates, that it's circular and it hangs upon nothing. that there are forces unseen that keep the earth in place. We know, obviously, with gravity. But the fascinating thing here is just this knowledge of Job. The pillars of the heavens tremble and are astonished at his rebuke. Now, the pillars of heaven, he called them the pillars of the earth before. What is he referring to? Well, he's referring to the mountains, that they tremble and are astonished at his rebuke. The idea of them holding up the sky type of thing, you know, that when God would shake the earth, it would be most visible within the mountains. He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding he breaks up the storm. By his spirit he adorned the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing spirit serpent. Picture language here for the constellations. This is, you know, what actually could he be referring to at this point? We're not exactly sure what constellation he's referring to, but he's giving this expression. But it's also interesting that in their days, they believed the stars had the glory of God that would depict to them the story. There's a lot of interesting insights you can read in some writings about the various stars and the constellations, the formations. A lot of that stuff has been corrupted. The signs of the zodiac type of thing, and getting into a person's zodiac sign, what's your sign? And, you know, I was born under the sign of Gemini, and so therefore my life is determined along this course because of that. That's all corrupted by Satan. But why was it so corrupted? Why is there such a counterfeit? If at least at first there may have been something to it that God intended, that the heavens do declare the glory of God. Now, when you look in the star and you see the various arrangements of stars, and then you learn through your books, you know, well, that's Cancer, that's Pisces, and that's whatever the names we ascribe to them. Now, you look at them and you think, now, how did they get a fish out of that? Or how did they get, you know, Gemini out of that? Or how did they get, and really, there's nothing really to the shape of the stars, or the arrangement of the stars that lend itself to these structures. But more, in fact, what is true behind this is that the stars had names. The prominent stars in the sky were given names. The names given to those stars and their arrangements, according to some scholars who have researched this, Bullinger does some really interesting studies on this called The Gospel and the Stars. He says if you look at some of the names of the constellations and the stars, they actually describe the story of creation, of God in what he did with his redemptive acts, the story of the gospel. When the Lord is speaking, and of course, you know, we would refer to the wise men who saw the star in the east, the wise men from the east saw this great star, they followed the star. Now, what exactly are they following and how are they following it? We don't really know. But it's interesting, their thoughts looking toward the stars. Now again, a lot of that was corrupted. I would not advise anyone to read their horoscope to find the gospel there, because you won't find it there. It's too far gone. But it is a fascinating thing. And of course, in Job's day, they would have had more familiar knowledge with the names of stars and the stories surrounding them. And then Job says, indeed, these are mere edges of his ways. And how small a whisper we hear of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter. Again, this picture that God, he is ascribing to God his condition. He knows it comes ultimately from God. It's not that he is blaming God unrighteously for doing unrighteously. He is just acknowledging the fact that God has done this. And he says, as long as is breath in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you're right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. In other words, Job is responding out of their prior arguments about his guilt, and he's saying, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sit here and tell you all these juicy wrong things that you think I did, so you can have this juicy gossip, you know. I'm not going to say, okay, guys, okay, this is what I did. He says, far be it from me to lie by telling you something I didn't do. I know it's what you want to hear. You want to hear I'm guilty. You want to hear I've done something very heinous that deserves this. But he says, far be it from me to say that you're right. Till I die, it won't put away integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he may gain much, if God takes away his life? You know, Job is kind of turning things on them at the same time, showing them the irony of this. What hope would I have being a hypocrite? If I'm pretending that I'm okay, that I haven't done anything wrong, what good does that do me? If God's taken away my life, what good is that? Their whole argument just falls completely apart. Will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God? In other words, does the hypocrite even have that tendency to do these things? I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? This is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. And now he goes on to describe the end of the wicked. But you see, the end result is the key. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep. In other words, it'll happen maybe in the next generation. Though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, these would have been symbols or emblems of wealth. He may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes. The rich man will lie down and will be not gathered up. He opens his eyes and he is no more. So in other words, his house is very temporary. It's like something that a watchman would make. Not one skilled in building, but someone that's just throwing something up together to stay out under the stars. It's only temporary. And the rich will lie down and not be gathered up. He opens his eyes and he is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. And men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. So ultimately, Job is expressing the wicked will be judged. So he agrees with his friends in that regard. It's just that they have made a wrong expression toward him. Now in chapter 28, Job has a very long discourse on the insights of God and some of the things of creation, and God as creator is quite emphasized. The idea here is you understand God has created things out of nothing, ex nihilo. And it's important for us to see that and to recognize that. Well, let's just jump in, look at this particular discourse, and we'll pick up on some of these points. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet. They hang far from men. They swing to and fro. And as for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the source of sapphires and contains gold dust. That path no bird knows, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams from trickling. What is hidden, he brings forth to light. So this idea here of there are secret places that no one knows about that bring forth many precious things. Now, I personally believe as much as we have mined the earth and extracted from it gold and silver and precious stones, that I believe we've probably just scratched the surface. that there are a great many discoveries in this world that we haven't even begun. In other words, we haven't fathomed it. The idea that sometimes we grow up that all things that can be known are known. You know, people grow up, there's so much knowledge to be known, no one can even come to that knowledge. Things are so specialized now. Used to be a person got this jack-of-all-trades degree where he was very accomplished in most of the sciences and the arts. Now you have to specialize right down to a very tiny little thing, and that becomes your specialty because there's so much discovered on that. In fact, even some of the little insects, we haven't even discovered all the insects that are even existing. We haven't discovered many of the things of creation yet. It's hard to imagine that, but we have scratched the surface. There are probably more species of insects that are alive than we even have categorized. That is how vast this subject is of nature. Not to mention the things below the earth, the dark recesses of every corner of this globe where secret things hide from the sharp eye of the falcon. And all these things are underneath what God has done. So he's describing these secret things, things that are very difficult to find, things that are very much in secret, but he uses this as a springboard to make his main point, and that is in wisdom. He says, but where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Whereas man can search in some of those deep crevices and the channels and can break in and find some of those hidden treasures. But where can wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. Seems like no one alive can really figure out what's the whole point. That's kind of what wisdom is. Wisdom is seeing the whole picture. It's making the right use of the knowledge. Sometimes people get so arrogant in their grasp of a few scientific facts, yet they're completely devoid of the whole picture. I think of people that are brilliant in their minds. Dr. Stephen Hawking and his ideas of the cosmos and time and physics. Brilliant in his sphere. Insightful. And yet, when you read his writings and you see some of the things he says, you see he's missing the whole picture. He doesn't see how it all fits in regard to God's plan, which is wisdom. That no one can find by searching. That no one can get in his own right. Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. You're not going to find it with the scientific method. It cannot be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir and precious onyx or sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, we have heard a report about it with our ears. God understands its way and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens. So God is the only one that can really grant the wisdom that's necessary for life. This is why Job has said, you know, the Lord understands my way. And when I'm tried, he'll come forth as gold. God has got this whole thing figured out. I don't know. I don't understand. You know, we try to understand. We try to figure out what it is that the Lord has done and what he's doing. When there's some tragedy that happens, we grasp at a reason for it. And sometimes, even if we don't have any reason, we try to ascribe a reason. We feel like we've got to have a reason. There's got to be an understanding here. But only God knows so often. He sees the whole picture. He sees the beginning from the end. Remember, we're in that dimension called time. That's very difficult for us to conceive of being out of that dimension, but that's what we're in. God is outside of time. It's hard for us to conceive of that, but time is a physical property. Where you have space, where you have matter and time, they all fit together. If you take one of those things out, the whole thing is thrown into a disarray and it doesn't work. Time is physical. When we're in eternity, time won't have the same meaning. It won't be like we're going to live for millions and millions and millions and millions of years. We'll be outside of that same concept of time. It'll be a different aspect. Yes, the Lord will reign on this earth for 1,000 years, and then He'll create the new heavens and the new earth. The former things will not be remembered. It will be a whole new dimension. And we'll see Him as He truly is, and we'll know Him just as He is, for as we have been known. So it is a fascinating thing to consider this, but God is outside that. He sees the whole thing. Kind of maybe a picture for this is if you're watching a parade go by and you look down and there come the floats, you know, and you're watching this big float of Barney or whatever it is, and it goes by, and then the band comes through and they're playing a particular song and you're watching that, then that's gone. Then something else comes. That's kind of like a picture of time. It constantly flows. And at any given point in time, you're right there. The band's right there right now. You know, or no, the float is there. And yet God, you see, if you could go far enough out or up in the blimp, you could look at the end of the parade and the beginning of the parade. Now, if I went farther ahead, I would see things that have not yet taken place. If I go farther back, I see things not yet that have happened. It's kind of an interesting concept of time. Perhaps it's similar in that respect. That if you went back in time, you'd see things that have not yet happened. And it, the concept of that, it's very difficult for us to conceive of being outside of time. We play the little time, we see those little shows that always play sometimes on time travel. And someone goes back in time or ahead in time. And generally, I mean, there's so many little things, you know, there's that paradox that can happen. If you see yourself when you were 5 years old, you know, then something will happen. Or how can you be in the same place, though you're the same person? But this idea where God sees the whole picture at once, it's beyond our comprehension, but He does. He knows the end from the beginning. He knows everything that ever will be, everything that ever can be. He knows it instantaneously, effortlessly. And now He uses a couple of pictures here in nature again. He says, to establish a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. Again, He goes back to that idea of hydrology, a developed science. Even the idea of aerodynamics is built upon this idea of wind having weight. Remember, that is a recent discovery. That's 300 years ago where that was confirmed that wind had weight. People didn't know that. Yet Job just spouts it off like it's common knowledge. Yet he establishes a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. Now what I want to point out to you, if you're talking to your skeptical friends about the Bible and they look at you like, you mean you really believe that book? How can you believe that? It's got so many errors in it. It's got so many problems and contradictions. And people always say that. And you ask them, really? What one do you think of in particular that maybe I could answer? Well, I really don't know. I heard somebody say that one time. But you know what? You point out some things in the Bible that fascinate them. Not that that's really going to sway them, but it should make them think. God has given us a strong witness. Maybe there were miracles in the past, like the crossing of the Red Sea, that got the heathen their attention for a moment. But if a person really looked closely at the Bible, he'd have to come to a conclusion. Man could not have written this book. He could not have known these things by his scientific method. God has revealed these things. He goes, when he made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt. Now, interestingly enough, Job's understanding of the thunderbolt and this phrase here is quite interesting. A law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt. There is the question that people often had. For a long time, they never equated lightning with thunder because they were so far from each other. In other words, you'd see the lightning, and maybe 20 seconds later, you'd hear the thunder. So you didn't realize that people didn't realize that they were one and the same thing. That the thunder was the sound of the lightning. We know that now, common knowledge, of course. And in fact, you can always tell how far the lightning is away, just by as you look at it. Then you count the seconds, and I always forget exactly how many seconds it means. And if I'm wrong, one of these days in the golf course, I'm going to be in big trouble. But the idea is that light travels a lot faster than sound. And yet people back then didn't know the same existed. Job exercises understanding there, that he understands that. In another passage, he makes that plain about the thunder and the lightning. Then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out. And to man he said, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and depart from evil is understanding." So he's expressed that very clearly. All these things that God has created, the decree for the rain, the way of lightning for the thunder. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Job's friends did not have wisdom. Eliphaz was like the voice of experience. He had kind of a psychological approach. He tried to encourage Job with a little positive thinking, but he still felt that Job was guilty. Bildad, the traditionalist, more philosophically minded in his outlook, you know, this is the way it has to be, this is where it's always been. Zophar was kind of like the religious dogmatist. He claimed to know all about God that anyone else knew. And each of these friends of Job that he is expressing did not have any wisdom. And Job simply expresses to them something that was pointed out later by the psalmist in the Proverbs: the fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So for all their charges against Job, he's expressed this: to depart from evil is understanding. You want understanding? Depart from evil. You want wisdom? Have a reverence, a deep fear and understanding of the Lord. That's the foundation. Job goes on, but his next discourse is, well, three chapters, and I don't think we're going to be able to take three chapters tonight. I think we've got a lot to chew on as far as our thoughts. We're going to pick up the next three chapters, really, we'll probably keep together as a whole, because then after that, another guy comes on the scene, a young man who's hanging out, who's been quiet up to this point. He's got a few things to say, Elihu, younger guy, and he's afraid to speak because he didn't want to, you know, speak against his elders. But he has a lot of interesting things to say. In fact, incredible insights for a young man. Yet he just misses that main point about Job, doesn't quite get that right. Yet he has a lot of very good things to say. His speech goes on all the way through chapter 36. And then God comes on the scene, and God is going to answer Job. And when we see God's answer, it's quite fascinating. So read ahead. Find out the end of the story. We'll pick up when we come back next time. Way through chapter 36, and then God comes on the scene, and God is going to answer Job. And when we see God's answer, it's quite fascinating. So read ahead. Find out the end of the story, and we'll pick up when we come back next time. Father, we thank you for your word. More than anything, we just sit here at your feet and pray that you just open our minds and hearts for wisdom. Teach us these things, Lord. Lord, that we would not put confidence in the philosophies of man or in the scientific dogmas that are pronounced so arrogantly as absolute facts, when oftentimes they're just theories. But Lord, that we would have confidence in your word. And we know that the beginning of wisdom is reverencing you and putting you in that rightful place in our minds and our hearts, letting you be our God, giving you that space to do what you will. Not fight you or argue with you about your purposes, but to learn how to be submitted under your designs. trusting that you'll work all things together for good to those who love you. Lord, I do pray for many who have gone through some difficult times. Especially lift up this couple again who lost their baby this week. And just not understanding, comprehending what you're doing, but maintaining that faith and trusting you and trying to figure it out, but knowing that even if they can't, you know. And Lord, we just commit all this to you. How we look to you, Lord, for those answers and wisdom. How we wait upon you, Lord. We pray that none would stand afar from you and keep away from your might and your knowledge. Lord, just as you have given Job such insight into the world around him, such things that were not discovered by scientific men till thousands of years later. Lord, we just thank you for all the more. It just stretches our hearts and minds to recognize you knew all along. You don't need that man should teach you about what you've created. And you're the one that's put all of the nature around us in such perfect balance. We wait upon you, Lord. Thank you.